Broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to heritageradionetwork.org.
Today's program has been brought to you by Hearst Ranch, the nation's largest single-source supplier of free-range, all-natural, grass-fed, and grass-finished beef. For more information, visit HearstRanch.com.
Well, welcome everybody. It's Sunday, so that means it's the main course. I am super excited to have in studio two guys who I really respect a lot, Mark Ladner and Brooks Headley. I want to say we're engineered by Jack Inslee and Joe Galarraga, and thanks to Hearst Ranch for sponsoring the show. Well, on behalf of all HRN, I am really excited. In fact, when I said that Mark and Brooks were going to be in studio, everybody who I work with, Jack and Aaron and Joe, were like, ask this question. So the questions are kind of an accumulation of the newly nonprofit staff of HRN. A brief bio, Mark Ladner is the executive chef of Del Posto Restaurant on Manhattan's West Side, which he opened in the fall of 2005. The restaurant received a 4-star New York Times rating in 2010 and has been honored with 1 Michelin star. Mark cooks a sensible interpretation of modern regional Italian-American cuisine, or Cucina Newyorkese. He is also the chef partner at Lupa Osteria Romana and Otto Enoteca Pizzeria. In 2010, he co-authored Molto Gusto with Mario Batali. We also have Brooks Headley in. He is an American musician and chef, best known as the drummer in several hardcore punk and indie rock bands. Headley is presently the executive pastry chef at Del Posto, a New York Times 4-star rated restaurant in New York City. Well, welcome, guys. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks,
Patrick. Pleasure to be here.
Well, I know this is not your first time at Roberta's. I've seen you guys here before, but never in the studio before, on the main course anyway.
It's hard to stay away.
Yeah, we love this place.
That's great. So, as I said, you know, these questions are some from me, some from Jack, some from Aaron, some from Joe, because everyone's really excited for you guys to be here. When we say a 4-star restaurant, that name, you know, is bandied about a lot by all the 4-star restaurants, but I believe you guys are the only Italian 4-star restaurant, which is an achievement.
That's true.
Very, very unusual. So, Mark, I'll start with you. Tell me about your influences. Your early influences, you know, at home and then eventually at the school in Rhode Island.
I guess what sort of led me to food in the 70s, my mom was a manager of a salad bar on Cape Cod, which was sort of an interesting concept at the time.
Like a free fixins bar, kind of
Well, it was the 70s, so you know, people were into eating healthy food at the time. It was the beginning of hippiedom, I suppose.
Communal mustards.
Yeah, exactly. And then I sort of found myself gravitating towards ethnic cuisines. The town that I grew up in had a tremendous influence of Middle Eastern cultures, Lebanese, Syrian, and the homes of my friends were traditional homes, and I was introduced to some of these flavors that are still some of my favorite today. And then beyond that, I mean, the industry just kind of chose me. I wanted to work. I liked the pirate ships of the restaurant community at the time that our good friend Anthony Bourdain has spoke so fondly of over the years, and it truly was that way. And it was an interesting way to start adolescence, so to speak.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, Middle Eastern cuisine is my favorite. Ann and I go out to this awesome Middle Eastern restaurant in Bay Ridge about once a week, and we just love it. And I would say, if I had to be cursed not to eat meat anymore, I would go Middle Eastern 14
you could
times
do it.
A week.
Yeah,
you
no,
could
that,
do
yeah,
it.
Totally. Like, you could make it happen, you know?
Yeah, it's really, really interesting. So, was it the pirate ship that pulled you in? I mean, if you had gone, I mean, the pirate ship mentality, or were you learning from a grandmother or mother or school?
Yeah, it was mostly Italian American, you know, sandwiches and pizza. and you know, just the camaraderie of a restaurant environment, small family business kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And you know, at that age, there aren't a lot of things you can do for work, and kept me mostly out of trouble. So,
and then did you learn a lot? I mean, there's always this question about, do you go to school or do you just apprentice? And you know, I know you went with a very famous other group of New York chefs. I believe Wiley Dufresne was with you, and there were a few other people.
I was more with him than he was with me.
Oh, I see.
I was hanging on to his coattails.
What did you learn from school, and do you recommend culinary school to people growing up, I mean, from your perspective?
It's sort of difficult to say. I think the most important thing is to kind of try to recognize your particular style in which you prefer to learn. You know, school, something structured like that could be very helpful for many people. For others, I mean, I've known many very talented and successful chefs that haven't gone to school and have not, you know, had any negative experiences, for lack thereof.
By the way, I just thought of it. Tannerine, that's the name of the restaurant talking about. Yeah. Tell us about you, Brooks. I mean, your early influences, how you got into the position you're at in a famous New York City kitchen. Our listeners would love to know.
I mean, I started making desserts completely by accident. It was never like a planned thing. Although my entire life I had really kind of been into food and sort of obsessed with it. And I just randomly got a job many years ago at what at the time was the best Italian restaurant in Washington, D.C.
Hmm.
And it was pretty much one of those things where, like, even though I hadn't gone to school and I hadn't really cooked professionally at all, like, literally the second that I walked into that kitchen, that professional kitchen, it was like I knew from that point on that this is what I was going to do the rest of my life. Like, and it was late. I was 27 at the time, too, so...
Now, interesting, you came as a drummer. I was joking with you right before the show, and I know you have an opinion on this, how the pastry chef, the drummer, you could even argue the goalie in soccer, you know, or while everyone is doing one thing in a big team of rushing back and forth, practicing, those three positions have in common that they're also doing that, but kind of alone, or doing different tasks.
Well, it's a different task or whatever, but... It's always been my goal, at least professionally in a kitchen, to make sure that, like, my staff that works with me sort of looks at what they're making as the same as the savory cooks. Like, it's all food.
Mm-hmm.
And even though what we're doing is it's a slightly different skill set, it doesn't necessarily need to have to be so separated. So that's, like, that's a pretty huge thing for me is to, like, is to make sure that, like, you know, sweets and desserts are seen as, like, just the stuff at the end of the meal rather than this completely separate, like, there's a, you know, like, the Berlin Wall comes down
right.
after the last protein course, and then it's, like, all of a sudden you're in a different restaurant, you know, so.
And relying on your palate and your sensibilities rather than a formula or a recipe.
Mm-hmm. I mean,
discipline.
At the front end, there's the bartender also who's in a similar situation where sometimes it's not viewed as part of the meal, especially in Europe and things like that, but it's a continuum from beginning to end. It's a whole singular experience.
No, that's a hugely, hugely important thing because when it comes down to it, the guest that comes in isn't necessarily looking to, like, check out the ego of this particular part of the kitchen. They just want to have an awesome time, you know. So.
For sure. Well, how many people on your staff... in the back end of the meal?
We have a pretty big staff because we do a lot of, like, you know, in-house parties and private dining and stuff like that. So
it's about a 400-seat restaurant. So
yeah,
400 seats.
So we have
we have about 200 employees.
Wow.
Yeah. No, it's.
And how many are in the? Do you commandeer to, you know, break new ground in the pastry world?
I think there's 8 of us right now, which is.
Very large.
It's huge.
Usually it's a person, you know, alone oftentimes.
Right, a person alone or like one or two people or whatever. So,
well, that is a great transition to the next question. I mean, so you start, you know, from humble beginnings and fast forward and you're trying to maintain a Michelin star and most importantly a 4 stars. in the New York Times, for only restaurant, Italian restaurant, to have that honor.
Yeah, it's pretty daunting. I mean, to be honest with you, and we haven't told many people, but very soon after receiving our fourth star, Brooks and I were so beside ourselves. We really didn't know quite how to digest it, and I don't think we've exactly figured out how to, even to this day. But for the first month or so, we were just, God, it was pretty scary. It was pretty scary.
We lost all our street cred.
It was touch and go over there for a while. We weren't sure we were going to survive at all.
Well, what was it about it? Was it the pressures of maintaining it, or that you had finally arrived to a goal you had worked so long to achieve?
I would say it would probably be primarily the insecurity of not necessarily feeling, that professionally we deserved it, or that it was even really that much of a goal of ours to begin with. I mean, from a business perspective, certainly the ownership always made it very clear that that's what the intention of the restaurant was. But at least from my perspective as a chef, I didn't ever feel I needed that sort of validation. I just wanted to try to cook good food and make create a restaurant that was going to be able to survive financially.
And when you say that you were, saying, "Oh, do we really deserve this?" Was it because you had tasted better foods at other places, or was it an internal thing about how the management is run, and your staff? Or
it's a difficult thing because Italian food, for many reasons, has never really been perceived as being capable, at least in the Manhattan community, of deserving the sort of rating of four stars. But what we were trying to do was create a fresher perspective on it's actually sort of an old school thing, but really trying to cater to the needs and desires of the guests themselves. So that's really what fine dining is. I mean, certainly internationally, everyone understands that a lot of the criteria for fine dining is changing. But as far as we're concerned, it's really just about catering to the guest.
Well, you bring up an interesting point, and I pose this question to both of you. But, on one hand, I know what's very important to your restaurants is maintaining truth to a tradition, mm-hmm. whether it be the Trastevere region in Rome.
We're definitely more of the traditional and classical school rather than the more modern school. But, you still have to sort of be trying to create an ideology that is moving forward and will remain relevant in the Manhattan dining climate.
Now, Brooks, right. Are your desserts Italian?
Yeah, I want to say completely Italian, even though they're not necessarily something that you would see in Italy, but the inspiration and the flavors and the way it's the presentation is, I would say, 100% Italian. For a number of reasons. I've actually never worked in anything but an Italian restaurant. So mm-hmm. In different levels, mostly fine dining, but so that's all I really, that's what I know. Mm-hmm. So, and, just from from the product and the presentation or whatever, that's the most important thing. Mm-hmm. To the point where there are times when we have just the most awesome fruit that we can get our hands on, stuff that kind of because we are who we are, we can actually get our hands on this stuff, mm-hmm. rather than manipulate it to the point of it's not comprehensible anymore.
Right, exactly.
I'm fine with just presenting it on, the fruit on a bed of ice to mm-hmm. the guest or whatever. Not necessarily because I'm being lazy, but just because
sometimes that's all there is to do.
And there's really nothing more Italian than something like that,
So. Yeah, fresh, things like that. Well, talking about the kitchen itself, we just walked through Bianca, the beautiful kitchen, and Is it true that you got to design the kitchen, Mark, of Del Posto? And
I mean,
how did you do now years after?
To a certain degree. I mean, I had some influence, but we hired a very, very professional kitchen designer by the name of Jimmy Yui, who's become a good friend of mine, and his work was nearly flawless. There was very little that I have complaint with now, even 8 years later, and there was no way that I had any of the knowledge necessary to have been able to fill that much square footage. Space is just too daunting to me. I could never have looked at a space and filled it. I mean, that's part of the thing. You're talking about a 24,000 square foot space, like, just to make it function is
it's the opposite as a whole.
I mean, it was a hole in problems. The hole in the ground, so I couldn't have fathomed trying to do something like that. But for the most part, it's worked out pretty well. It's more of an older school. It's certainly not of the more modern international style of kitchen, but it's also a much larger venture than a lot of these other smaller boutique places. And the purpose of it is to create food for lots of people. You know, it's not a vanity project. It's a big business. Mm-hmm. You
know? For sure.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, talking about what fills this kitchen, Jack wanted me to ask, do you listen to Cooking Issues, the Dave Arnold show? And I was going to then use that as a transition into, you know, the high-tech luxuries and challenges that come with that, that you have the ability to use at Del Posto, A, to fill up the space, B, because you have so many people coming in, you can do this. So can you talk about some of the tools? Well, first of all, do you guys listen to Cooking Issues?
I mean, hey, we love Dave, so.
Okay.
I never have listened to the show, but I read it online pretty religiously.
Fantastic. And,
he is certainly an incredible, you know, brain of science and food, and just his general sensibility is just hilarious and awesome. I recently was traveling with him in Japan, and was able to go to, you know, the fish market and a bunch of other places with him, and just actually watch him work, which is it's just.
What type of work is he doing? Like, as an example,
just modernist style cocktails using a lot of science focused equipment, but I mean, the guy loves food and he loves knowledge, and he ultimately wants things to taste really, really good. So, I mean, I don't think you'll find very many people in the food community saying that they're trying to make something that doesn't taste delicious.
True.
You know?
And the thing about Dave too is, like, there's like a sense of humor in his presentation of his, like, vast, crazy knowledge that like kind of humanizes it, which is totally awesome, you know? Mm-hmm. So
I have to say, Mark, you get mentioned quite a bit on the show, and not always for cooking. I'm going to leave it at that.
Oh, God, good thing I don't listen.
So now, can you tell some of our listeners about some high-tech tools or some of the chefs that might be listening, like things that they might not get access to in a normal everyday kitchen that you guys are trying to master? Or
we decided very early on, Mario and I, that we didn't want to... we wanted to focus on more traditional styles of cooking with fire and things like that. We have invested in a couple pieces of equipment that are exciting, like a super freezer, for example, that essentially cryogenically freezes food.
Or people.
Or sperm or whatever whatever you might want to throw in it.
That's big business for the Heritage breed. So that's sperm going around.
We're trying
around
to segue into
time.
That market, but we haven't got the licensing yet.
Create a Cesare breed. I always secretly thought Cesare's Stonewall breed was part Cesare, but...
That's really gross. thank you, Patrick.
Sure. So you use that, and what does that allow you to do? Just preserve things that are getting old, or does that add a certain element of taste?
It preserves freshness.
Oh.
in ways where oxygen isn't allowed to expand in the freezing process. So, for example, we can buy an entire tuna, 150-pound tuna, and break it into small sort of like sushi bars and freeze it. And if we continue to handle it responsibly, we could take it out 6 months later, defrost it responsibly, and it's essentially of the age that it was when we put it in.
Unbelievable. So it's really how cold amazing. Is that? It's then? Kelvin scale zero?
It's negative 80 Celsius. Yeah.
Celsius.
Right.
Yeah. Wow.
It's cold.
That's tremendous.
It'll burn you. It'll burn you.
How big is it? I mean, is this a big...
It's like slightly bigger. I mean, it's like
it's about the size of a coffin.
Coffin, yeah. Disney, Walt Disney is turning over in his cryogenic machine. What about you, Brooks? Anything interesting that you get to play with or try to figure out?
We have that freezer, which I obviously use for me. I use it for purposes of speed. Like, I can get stuff frozen very quickly. Mm-hmm. For the most part, I tend to be more of like the grandma style in terms of like of techniques or whatever. Not because I'm necessarily opposed to modern techniques or don't know about them. I do. It's just for what we do. I find that oftentimes if we're researching a technique for a dish or whatever, and we'll try a bunch of sort of crazy stuff, it usually comes back to like the Nona with the bowl, tearing the stuff, not even using a knife kind of thing. So
and that's really the spirit that we always wanted to maintain and retain. The restaurant's now almost 8 years old, or at least from the time that we purchased the equipment. So we recently have bought newer and more modern stuff, but most of the choices we made were more driven by ecological ideology and buying things that created less of a carbon footprint, more electric and more what's that called? Induction.
Yeah.
Which gives off a lot less heat, a lot less carbon, and allowed us to turn down, for example, our hood fans and things, so that we were just expelling less energy in general.
Mm-hmm.
Which is something that's important to us.
You were very always into that from the water, and in fact I think the forager was a role that was pioneered maybe in the 70s and 80s. You guys helped pioneer this kind of HACCP plan ecological person, wasn't Elizabeth?
Yeah,
Meltz
Elizabeth
came
Meltz,
and talked to us about all that.
She's helped us so much, and it was sort of a serendipitous situation, but she started as a cook at Del Posto and then became our kitchen manager and then created this position for herself in Mario's office, where several years ago there was really no room or no one sort of had the sort of a vision to be able to expend the amount of I guess what I'm trying to say is that it's turned out to be a tremendously valuable thing for not just Del Posto but for the rest of the restaurants in our organization, because for example, the health department has become much more vigilant in trying to get people and restaurants to perform and responsible ways, and she helps keep us correct, and she helps keep us informed about what's happening out there, and it's been a tremendous advantage for us, and at this point I couldn't imagine not having her in that role.
Does it save money, just like yes or no, like in the end are you actually
in fines that she saves us alone? I'm sure she pays for her salary. And that's the other thing, in a larger corporation like ours, we can justify a lot of these things financially, which is a tremendous luxury.
Well, you brought up something else. Once I asked you what cuisine do you find the most fascinating, many years ago you responded with Japanese cuisine. I don't know if that's still the same, but since then I've asked hundreds of chefs that question, and men, such a high percentage agree with you. So you were just there. What impresses you so much about Japanese cuisine? I ask you too, Brooks.
I like like it, there's just this obsession with like, kind of like one thing sometimes.
Yeah.
And that's like
the singular concept is what I found the most interesting. I mean,
interesting.
And just like the fact that like, if you like, you can work for a sushi chef and for years not do anything but like make the rice.
Fan the rice.
Fan the rice.
Yeah, that's a good job for you, Patrick.
I'll do it, man. I would go crazy. I'm so ADD.
but even like if you like if you're in Osaka or Tokyo, and I've been a couple times, like just the commitment to complete excellence of like almost everything like food related is like it's just so advanced and like
it's such like diligence and determination and just that singular focus on. For example, if you go to a tempura restaurant, like you can only have fried food. And if you don't want that, you are fucked and you have to go next door.
But that's all right, because there's like six places
down the street,
in up in the top of the building through the weird elevator.
So the people are eating out a lot in that culture, right? I mean, there are a lot of little restaurants. I mean,
they're eating in the subway. They're eating in the sub-basement of malls. It's really bizarre. A lot of the Japanese aren't eating on street level.
Is it clean and safe and all that?
Absolutely. It's just overwhelmingly dense. You know?
Yeah. It's a lot of people.
There are a lot of people in those big cities.
And like what you see proliferating in Manhattan, for sure, but certainly other parts of the country, is like this concept of azakaya, which is sort of like a Japanese restaurant that does a little bit of everything. I actually didn't see very many azakaya in Japan at all. Like if you go to a yakitori restaurant, you are eating chicken on a stick, and that's it.
Hmm. Yeah. Very interesting. That's funny. I was wanting to invest significant, you know, money for me significant in a single alcohol or two. You know, I was like, what would I do? And sure enough, I come driving with the car with the back full of sake, you know, because I find it the nicest drunk. And it's also like, I mean, you know, kind of high. And it's so refined. It's not wine. It's not beer. So it's what made me want to ask the question. But no, very, very interesting stuff. Well, I mean, I wanted to ask you guys, Brooks, this is for you. I wanted to know, Aaron asked this question, our executive director of HeritageRadioNetwork.org. What do you think about the recent trend of restaurants / catering companies outsourcing their pastry production? Basically not keeping a pastry crew in-house.
I mean, I've heard about that, and I guess it usually comes down to not having to have, you know, a pastry chef or like a pastry staff on the payroll and being able to like say get something from that's like sort of in like that same way, like singularly made ice cream or whatever. If you find the best like sort of outsourced ice cream and then you serve that, you know. And, you know, I've maybe not so much in New York as far as I know, but in other cities I've heard about that a lot, like in like smaller restaurants or whatever. You know, it really depends on like the size of the place. Mm-hmm. And
but it could also be a restaurant getting big and saying, hey, let's find one test kitchen that produces everything and then gets it back out.
Yeah, yeah, I know. I mean, that could...
It's consolidating resource in general.
Right, right.
I mean, can you guys do that? I mean, have you guys ever thought about a fast food franchise that still produces very high quality thing? I mean, can you wrap your head around that? Because that is a big answer. It would provide a lot of answers to an American population that suffers from, you know, in many ways dealing with food. So it'd be interesting to get your guys' perspective.
Fast food pastry departments?
Or fast food, just bringing what you guys do to, you know, a wider level. Like maybe could there be gas stations that serve your kind of food on an industrial level?
Patrick, we have more ideas related to this than the constraints, time constraints.
it's super true.
So can you tell us the best idea? I mean, if you had to go with one right now.
About this. It's my jam.
$100 million. What would you guys, would it be a taco place? Would it be a hamburger joint?
Mm.
Too much. Next question. Grass-fed versus grain-fed. Thoughts? No. Well, that's... Very interesting. Well, this is from Aaron. We're just kind of, this is now the hodgepodge of questions. You can see the ones that they would walk out on me if I didn't ask. Aaron actually asked, well, I won't even ask her off the record questions, but is it hard on your back being tall in the kitchen?
Nah, not particularly. I have two words of wisdom. Change your socks often and rotate your shoes.
Change your socks often. You know, Jordan used to rotate his shoes every game. So
there you go. Yeah.
So you rotate them.
We're
That's
trying to bring that same level of viscosity to the kitchen.
Well, for our listeners who've never seen Mark, he is built. He is very, very, very strong. Great stomach muscles.
Built by beer.
Great posture. Well, then, is there a food trend you would like to see but haven't? Not really.
70 salad bars, Patrick.
70 salad bars. Are you trying to give your mom
just, that? Just like the Google cafeterias. Have you been? Have you checked
Yes,
out
I have been to one of those.
Fascinating.
Absolutely. Did they do a good job?
Amazing, I thought so, yeah.
You're talking here in front of Chelsea Market or out on the West Coast?
I've only seen the one here, but yeah, I was really impressed. I want to work there.
I've been out to the Google guys in the Valley, Silicon Valley, and they have, like, you know, you can choose from amongst 12 places. Each one specializes in its own thing, right. And the employees are provided bicycles so that they can get back and forth. Yeah. So what fascinates you about that so much? The number of people they serve or...
Just the fact that they had enough vision to keep everything in-house and to treat their employees so well that they don't particularly want to or have any real reason to leave, so they can just work all the time.
And they're eating leaves.
Yeah. No, they eat really healthy. I guess part of the strategy, I was told, is that they put the least healthy food sort of at the very end of the queuing system so that, I guess, in theory, you would fill your plate with the healthier stuff first, which I'm sure for a corporation that size with that many employees, healthcare costs are an issue.
Whole Foods, you know, rewards their employees for passing certain tests, you know, and reaching certain marks, and then they get discounts on their insurance. It's a very interesting. Is that something Del Posto employees should look forward to as a new... you know, staff meal is now going to be spread throughout the restaurant.
Sure.
Yeah. Well, let's see. I guess we're coming kind of towards the end of the interview. You guys have been absolutely great to be on. I guess I'd like to ask you, is there a thing or two that stands out to you most, having worked with Mario and Joe for so long? Is there a lesson you carry from them more than others?
Good Lord, Patrick, where do I begin?
I know you guys are so close, so that's it's a tough question. This was not written earlier.
They've been obviously a tremendous influence on my career, and I owe so much of what I've been able to achieve to their support and their ultimate vision. They've taken Italian dining in America to places that maybe it would never have reached without their involvement, and they continue to support, you know, their valued employees in ways that that keep them loyal, which is a tremendously valuable skill in the longevity of any career or the, you know, the life of a corporation.
What about you, Brooks?
Malto Mario was just like the greatest TV show. So
yeah,
I mean, it was literally like,
where are you, Malto Mario?
It was it was even before like I cooked professionally or whatever. Like I would watch that show and I'd be like, this guy's completely insane. He's like, he's cooking in real time, and he's just talking the whole time. Literally, like just like projectile vomiting information.
Yeah, no, exactly.
Like in this way that it was like blew my mind. Like, couldn't
high standard.
Especially at the time, like information wasn't streamed that way. It was almost impossible to digest because nobody did it that way. Nobody.
Hmm.
And unfortunately, none of the shows are like that anymore, which is quite sad. But
well, don't even get me started. I mean, since the Food Channel started 15 years ago, there has not been 30 minutes of serious content.
That's why radio's back, Patrick.
Radio's there back, baby. I'm talking pesticides, slaughterhouses, animal rights. I mean, go on and on and on. I could care less about some foie gras producer in Northern California that got thrown in jail. I mean, the crimes against our animals are being committed on a much bigger level by, you know, much bigger companies.
Of course, absolutely.
Someone has to cover those issues sometimes. Not all the time. They don't have to change the focus of their paper, but to write about these issues, like food, without covering the biggest obstacles to those foods, you know, seems somewhat unfair.
So. I was telling Brooks, actually, on our ride over here about how our relationship, yours and mine, started when Heritage first started getting into the wholesale game, and some of the trips that you took me on out west to meet the farmers and see the animals, and it was just such a revolutionary idea, and I'm so glad that you've been able to make it and continue to make it so successful, because people really need access to that sort of responsibly and sustainably raised livestock that didn't exist before you, Patrick.
You're
a pioneer.
Well, it's funny. Everyone's like, why the red wattle? And I was like, you know, when I thought about it, I was like, it's because Mark Laudner came to Kansas. It's juicy, but it could have been a Gloucester Old Spot that he had tasted, and it would have been the Gloucester Old Spot. Substitute red wattle with Gloucester Old Spot if it had been a large black.
Because those little wattles crisp up so nice.
They're not edible. No, but it was a very, very historic meeting. There's about 60,000 pounds of meat sold 52 weeks a year, thanks to something that you're still one of the top three biggest buyers, always, usually the number one biggest buyer across all the restaurants across the nation. That's 60,000 pounds of meat a week over 8 to 10 years. You can imagine, it's pretty powerful. So thanks for sticking with us all those years, like when I was delivering meat in a U-Haul truck. And
I remember,
brother, that was before Elizabeth Meltz.
Shout out to Pat LaFreda.
Yes, Palafrida, who, by the way, was on a couple weeks ago and was so fantastic. I mean, that guy has got such a great sense of humor and way of synthesizing things that everyone thinks about but doesn't really know anything about.
Celebrity butcher. Giving Dario a run for his money.
We had a staff meal yesterday, and I was so proud. Nick Fantasmas was there, and Silva from the Heritage Meat Market. I was like, I love that we have a party, and there's not one but two butchers present full-time. Anyway, thanks so much for coming on. Really, you guys should be on 1,000 more times. We had 400 more questions, but I really look up to you guys. You guys do it with class, and you live up to your expectations very, very well. So it's a real honor for the network to have you on.
Thanks, Patrick.
Thanks, guys.
Right. Bye. Take care.
Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef. Pasture-raised on 150,000 acres in Central California. Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, free-range, sustainably produced, humane. Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, the authentic flavor of the American West.
All right. Wow, what an interview. Joe, what did you think of that interview?
It was pretty awesome. It was cool that you got such food stars in the studio, Patrick.
Would you go so far as to say it was one of the top 400 interviews I've ever done?
Yeah, definitely top 400. Maybe even top 300.
350. Let's say 350. Well, we are in studio right now with one of my favorite people over the years at Roberta's, but you were bona fide, definitely, Ann Saxelby's favorite. When she heard that you were coming on, she's like, tell Katie hi. So we are in studio with Katie Peets, who is the pastry chef of Roberta's. Welcome, Katie.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Oh, I'm so excited you could be on. So tell us about your pastry philosophy, just for people who haven't been to Roberta's recently, to understand what inspires you.
Well, I think my philosophy is always evolving and changing, but I've been doing pastry here for the past year, and before that I was doing savory at Roberta's, and before that I was doing savory, and that's what I went to culinary school for. So I feel like my food definitely has that, like, savory element, but still being dessert. Earthy, bitter flavors, a little salty, but you see salt in a lot of desserts now. But yet still being, you know, dessert nostalgic and bringing back childhood memories, mm-hmm. and just having something that you would want to still be part of the meal, but end your meal with.
Hmm. So you had no intention of becoming a pastry chef when you first started working on Savory Roberta's?
No.
Wow. How did that happen?
Our pastry chef left in February, and Carlo just kind of, to me, out of the blue, asked me. But I was talking to Brandon about it, and he's like, no, Brandon, we talked about it. But it was out of the blue for me. I was just at a point where I was ready for something new and different, and it just kind of happened. And I wasn't even sure about, I was a little reluctant about taking it, but I love it, and I have a sweet tooth, definitely. Mm-hmm. And it's just really fun. You get to be a little bit more creative, and your brain functions a little bit differently than unsavory, which I like.
Well, for sure. I mean, when Brooks was on, we were laughing that the pastry chef, the drummer in a band, and then the soccer goalie, you know, while like the whole band is like hanging out, the drummer is like putting his things together, kind of like off to the side, a whole different set of drills. Mind thinks in a different way. Super interesting. By the way, where you said culinary school, where did you go again?
I went to the French Culinary Institute.
Oh, yeah, Dorothy Cowan Hamilton.
I know.
You've seen her around,
yeah,
huh? Her
she's
show.
Awesome.
Yeah, she's got a really good show. So you're from Omaha, Nebraska, center of the country. Or no, you're from Nebraska.
I grew up in a small town, but I went to college in Omaha at Creighton.
Okay.
And most of my friends are in Omaha.
So did you grow up on a farm?
No.
No?
I think I'm always asked that question. No, I did not grow up on a farm, but both of my parents are from pretty small towns. My mom grew up in a town of 800, and they were like the bankers of the town. And even though my grandpa didn't farm, he still had a pasture in his backyard and rented out the land.
So what did you grow up eating?
I grew up eating typical Midwestern food.
Potatoes.
Steak, of course. Lots of like casseroles. Kind of food that you don't want to eat every day, but when I go back home, I love eating it.
Oh, brother. So what were your early influences? I mean, when did you first know that you were going to dedicate your life or at least make a run for it in food?
You know, it's interesting. I didn't really start cooking until I was in high school, and that was just, I don't even know how I got into it. My mom is she's a good home cook, but nothing crazy, and my grandma's this is the same thing, but I had a couple aunts that liked to cook a lot, and I just, there's like little defining moments when, and we love to travel, and food is such a huge part of traveling.
Around the U.S. or the world?
The world. I'm not like a world traveler, but even, I studied abroad in the Dominican Republic in college, places that aren't even foodie places, but it's just, I think I just was so drawn to that culture, and that's how you connected with somebody that you don't even know their language. But I did do a summer program in Ireland, and I got to go to Italy for 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. And I just traveled along the Amalfi Coast, and I think I was in Cinque Terre, and I was like, oh my God, this is what I'm supposed to do. Yeah, I'm going to culinary school.
Now, since we're talking about, you know, when you told me you had a pet pig and you were from Nebraska, I wasn't surprised, but this pig actually was from Chile. So Chile was, the country Chile was a big influence on you. You lived there for a while. Tell us about that experience and why you were there.
So after culinary school, I staged, which is like the culinary term for interning for free, at Blue Hill in the city. And it was great, and I learned a lot, but I was just ready to not be in a little cement kitchen box 24 hours a day, not having a life.
How old were you at the time?
I was 22, 23 maybe?
Young.
And then, so I just knew I needed to get out, and I wanted to travel again. And I found a job cooking at a fly fishing lodge in Patagonia in the middle of nowhere. And myself and two other cooks flew out there. It was all our first time, and we worked for just this fly fishing lodge for like 5 months. And
how did you find the job from here?
I found it on the French Culinary Institute website, but the other two had found it through Craigslist. And actually, oddly enough, Max, the chef de cuisine, was at that same lodge cooking 2 years before I was.
What a small world.
Yeah, I mean, only a handful of people have done that job.
I have a small world story with Max. He used to be the chef of Eve restaurant in Michigan, and he always had to deal with me because she would order shanks every week. And then, sure enough, years after we knew each other, he's like, I'm the Max from Eve. I'm like, oh my God, what a small world.
Awesome.
So, and what did you learn in Chile? I mean, what do they do that you still carry with you?
I think the fact of where I am now probably wouldn't have happened if it weren't for Chile. I mean, we had a lot of responsibility, obviously, since we're in the middle of nowhere. We couldn't really buy a lot of food, so we made everything. We did our own bread, our own sourdoughs. All our soups were from stocks that we made. We would do lamb roasts once a week from the neighbors down the street who raise the lamb. And
all grass-fed, right? The beef down there? Or do they also...
No, it is mostly grass-fed. But actually,
They figured out corn by now.
Yeah, I think they would... I know some of them were finished on grass.
Okay, on corn.
Yeah, finished on corn. Like, raised on grass, finished on grain. But it was amazing.
How long were you there?
Just for 5 months, fly fishing season.
Wow.
And then, yeah.
That's awesome. Well, then you come back to the city and hook up with Roberta's. And now you're as a pastry chef in this competitive world. I mean, how the hell do you deal with it? I posed the same question to Mark Ladner and Brooks Headley earlier. There's a lot of pressure out there. I mean, there's a million restaurants doing desserts. How do you cope with that and be unique while still doing traditional things?
I honestly don't ever think of it that way. I don't. The only pressure I have is the pressure I put on myself. And just, I think it's good. It's a healthy pressure because you're in the best food city, arguably the best food city in the world. And it is really competitive, but I'm a competitive person and I function better in that sort of environment. And being at Roberta's, I feel like we're far enough outside of Manhattan that you just are doing what you love. And, you know, you still have amazing resources. And I love going to the farmer's market. And I love, you know, our forager and the fact Melissa Metrick, who does the garden. I mean, she's amazing. So when you have all those things that, like, inspire you, you're not thinking about, oh, I need to think about being creative and I need to think of something really cool.
How does that relationship work with the gardener? Do you commission certain things or does she provide and then you try to use them?
This is her second summer, and last summer was, you know, she just kind of like pretty much rebuilding the whole thing. But in the spring, she sat down with all the cooks and was like, what do you want me to grow? And she brought in magazines and showed us seeds. And basically, she knows more about plants than I do, so I trust her, but she does a great job.
So what's on the menu, for instance, like today, if someone were to come after the show?
Well, at brunch, we do gelato if you ask for it.
Okay.
And so I think my flavors today are chocolate, and I usually have two flavors, and then like...
Rum raisin?
No. Oh. I know, that's so funny.
That's my favorite and your dad's favorite.
My grandpa's favorite.
Grandpa's.
I know, I tried making a rum raisin once, and I've yet to, like... I was
nail
like,
it.
Okay, but I think Haagen-Dazs rum raisin is amazing.
Yeah. They're good, right?
Yeah, I think they're one of the best. If we're going to talk about store ice cream. But, so I have gelatos, but then my two desserts, I always try to have, like, one that's a little bit different.
Okay.
And that one is, I just put on, and I really like it. It's a watermelon radish gelato, so I actually steep slices of watermelon radish in my milk, and then use that milk to make the gelato, and then it has, like, sour watermelon gummies, and little watermelon pieces, and a macadamia nut crumble.
Oh, man.
It's different. It's kind of funky because radish isn't necessarily a dessert food, but that's why I like it because it kind of pushes it.
How does the tasting process work here? I mean, you come up with the dessert and then will you present it to Max and Carlo or?
I usually just kind of, whatever I have in my mind in the beginning never ends up like that. So I just kind of play with flavors and I'll talk to them and say, this is what I want to do. I want to use this ingredient and this herb and this texture. And then I just make stuff. And it's not like it has to get okayed by them, but it's they, I mean, they help me through the process.
Sure,
so
it's a
like,
collaboration.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I want their input.
So what have you learned? I mean, Carlo is a very well-respected chef. Roberta's obviously is a critically acclaimed restaurant. What would you say, like, for our listeners, you know, who might want to get into the industry, what have you learned working at Roberta's and at Bianca, the new tasting restaurant?
Blanca,
sorry.
I've learned that, I think for one, you just need to be a hard worker, and that's what that's what's saying any restaurant. You need to learn how to work really hard, and you need to know your ingredients. That's one thing I learned from Carlo, just knowing your ingredients. Don't try to mess with it too much.
That's connected to what Mark and Brooks were saying, that they love Japanese food because of the singular concept, that single item and getting the most of it, rather than overwhelming, complicated.
Totally. And that's Carlo's heavily influenced by Japanese food as well. And it's just
raw
like
fish.
There's a purity about it that you can't find in a lot of other cooking.
Purity, like Philadelphia cream cheese. Tell us about that, the famous lemon cream cheese saddles.
So embarrassing.
By the way, just so you don't feel so bad, Mark Gladner says the best mustard in the world is Gouldens, and he uses Gouldens in the kitchen. So you're
not
alone.
That's a little different. Well, this is for a contest. That was actually right when I got back from Chile, and it was before I started working here. And my friend's a videographer, one of my best friends is. And there was this, and I have another friend whose aunt is like the food stylist and like part of the team of Paula Deen, and they were like, oh well, you know, she's doing this Philadelphia cream cheese contest. I couldn't tell you the last time I had Philadelphia cream cheese. It's great stuff though. It's awesome.
Listen, I have it every weekend on my bagel. It's pretty
really?
tasty. It's just not what the original cream cheese was. And says like her cream cheese is very, I guess, bitter or sour or something like that. It's
Well, yeah, I mean, not it's very smooth. Processed.
Yeah.
But it was really fun doing that. And that was even before I was doing pastry. So I look back at that and I'm like, oh, my gosh.
Things have changed.
Yeah. But it was really fun doing that.
So now that you, it's funny, I've noticed this trend in sweets where there's more savory added to it. And it's interesting, your career as an example, being savory and then going to sweets. Is it gone too far? I mean, talking about trends, I mean, is sometimes people wanting a dessert and instead they get like an after-dinner appetizer?
You know, it honestly just depends on the person and the restaurant experience that they're having. I mean, essentially when you go out to eat, you are eating somebody else's palate. You know, it's not... it's like a balance between that and then also being satisfied with the food that you're eating and that you're paying for it. I think maybe it can go too far, but it's just about balance, you know, and everybody's taste buds are so different and everybody wants something different. And, you know, if you want something really sweet, just you can go to the bodega and get a chocolate bar. But if you want to look at dessert as part of the meal and something different and something that's like you look at and you're like, there's, I don't even know how they made this. I couldn't make this. It just depends on what you want.
It's important when you go to a restaurant, you should, I always think, be as open as possible to new experiences that you can't duplicate so easily as a novice. Well, I mean, that's an interesting thing. So should people be ordering dessert at the beginning of meals? I've never understood that because Brooks just said it a few minutes ago. He doesn't want to be viewed as something after dinner, something separate from it. It's part of a whole experience, just like Damon says the same about cocktails before the meal. So how come people don't... would you do better if you had 45 minutes or an hour to prep?
What do you mean, 45 minutes?
Like if someone ordered at the beginning of the meal, and so you got your dessert order 2 hours or an hour and a half before, would that change anything if you had that time?
No, for me it wouldn't, because I have all my stuff ready by 5 o'clock when we start dinner. Whoever is working on the salad station is plating my desserts. So it wouldn't really affect me. I think it'd be interesting. I don't know that I would... necessarily want to go at the beginning of the meal or serve a dessert at the beginning. Maybe feels like a little bite of something, but I think that I would just like people to always have dessert in the back of their head while they're eating, so they don't just eat a ton of food and like are completely stuffed for for dessert.
Yeah, you have to really keep it in mind.
Yeah.
It'd be interesting to see, at least I think, at the very least, the dessert should be presented on the menu so that people see it. And then when it's dessert time, they get that same menu back so that they can plan it. Because, you know, in the end, then they might get and be like, oh my God, I love that dessert. I should have saved some room, but they didn't know going in.
Yeah.
Anyway, well, it's just interesting. Because
do you have that problem?
Yes, I'm just like, I got too fat from 8 to 10 p.m. And now, that's why Fernet exists and weed. Were you part of that weed dinner?
I was.
What did you do?
I made the dessert. It was actually a really good dessert. And I don't particularly like smoking weed. And so I looked at it as just another herb to cook with, and that was really cool because it's got a very distinct flavor, and it was fun to match it and see what it works with and what it doesn't work with. And I learned a lot. It was like a science experiment. It was so cool, and it was just really fun. It was just really fun, and it was a cool experience. But I made a parsley wheat cake, and then I did all sorts of little like crumbles, and I did a hemp seed granola crumble that I actually put on the menu now, but without THC.
Okay.
Put on the menu now.
I was
now.
About to run out. Order it.
I put it on the menu now with a cherry hyssop semifreddo. And I think I love that dessert. And I don't really like cherry that much, but I really like it with hyssop. Is anise hyssop, so it's got that, it's like a fennel herby flavor. But because we're in summer and we have hyssop plants instead of just fennel seeds, it's like this awesome earthy flavor without the medicinal component that hyssop or that fennel usually has.
Very interesting. So favorite ingredient of the season, is it?
Ooh, that's a tough one. It changes every week.
Really?
Right now, corn.
What's the it ingredient?
The it ingredient? I mean, there's a, can I give you top five?
100%.
Okay. I love TriStar strawberries, which I get at the market.
What do you mean, the little guys?
Yeah.
The wild ones? Oh my God, those are the best. Do they domesticate those, or are those wild?
They say that they're like a hybrid between wild and, but this woman, Franca, with her Stanberry Treasures, has like the best TriStars ever. I like those. The plums this year are amazing. The yellow ones, I think they're called, I can't remember what they're called, like Shiro plum.
Is that raised here in this
region? I've been getting them at Locust Grove, which is also at the market. They're like one of my favorite apple and plum. Mm. Franca also has these really good black raspberries. We have wild red raspberries that the bush was here before Melissa, and they're really good. The sun gold tomatoes, I really like sun golds.
Interesting. So they're like tomatoes, huh? I mean, they're just regular.
They're tomatoes. They're so sweet, though. They're the yellow ones. They're always sweeter.
Tomato is a fruit now. Okay, one mustn't forget.
Yeah, they're amazing. I have one more ingredient, but I feel like I need to be really careful about this.
Don't worry, no one is listening. We have absolutely no listeners, right? Joe, you can confirm that, right?
Yeah, just check the stream. Nobody listening.
Nobody listening. It's official.
I don't know. I'm excited for really good corn to come in. But I'm from Nebraska, and I have yet to taste any corn in New York that compares to Nebraska.
You are the Corn Belt. I mean, we always joke at the office. I'm always asking everyone to rate the top 10 terroirs in America. Hmm. And everyone's like, Oregon. And what about, you know, Napa Valley? And I'm like, dude, what about the Corn Belt? Like, that feeds the world.
Yeah. It gets really dry sometimes, though.
Huh. So you like corn? That was the one you were afraid to say?
No, but I just need to be careful about it because I only have one more choice left.
Oh, I see. That's what you meant. I thought it was a secret, like no. Mark Bodner not telling us about his next franchise idea, which is my last question for you when you're done. So what's the last one? So far, we have the tomatoes. We have the...
I think that was all of them. Tomatoes, corn, TriStar strawberry, black raspberry.
A black raspberry?
And then...
The plum?
The plum.
Yeah.
I don't, but like, if you ask me that question in 10 minutes, I could give you.
Hey, we should have a top five list every few weeks and just see how it changed. Yeah. It would be an interesting documentation. So, you know, as a last question, we always are such fans of the culture that you guys push forward day in and day out. What trend would you like to see that you haven't seen yet? Almost like with an eye towards maybe it becoming a national phenomenon versus just something that happens in Brooklyn or in, on the East Coast.
This is like trend as in restaurants or just pastry?
Something,
or?
Yeah, is there something that America should have on its everyday Applebee's menu or an ingredient or something that, like if you were given $1 million to open a fast food chain with what you do. Like,
that sounds scary. I mean, I think, like you said it, I think creating more of a culture in restaurants and finding, which I think was why I'm at Roberta's and why I love it, is that it, you know, it's not just a restaurant, it's a culture, and it caters to anyone who wants to spend and who has a lot of money, or anyone who doesn't have a lot of money. True. And can still come in and have a really good meal. Mm-hmm. But mostly a culture. Like you can't really pay for culture. You know, it's got to be created, and there's few places that do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is a real, it's got its own orbit, that's for sure. If people haven't been, they should come. Yeah. They get a chance to taste Katie Pizza's delicious.
Make sure you save room for dessert.
Yeah, please, save room for dessert, or nip it in the bud, put the dessert on the menu so people can plan for it at least, or even order it.
Yeah.
Some people might be so sure early on. Anyway, well, it's always so nice to see you. You're such a positive energy. You're so talented
Thank
with
you.
What you do in the kitchen. So thanks so much for coming on. It's
Thanks.
A real honor, and we'd love to have you back. I mean, top five ingredients.
Top five.
Everyone would want to hear that. Well, we've been engineered by Joe Galarraga, sponsored by Hearst Ranch. Thanks to Mark Ladner and Brooks Headley and Katie Peets for being on, and we'll see you next week on The Main Course.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our programs archived on our website or by searching iTunes for Heritage Radio Network. You can find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website. Thanks for listening.